Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. The Let's Get Busy podcast is produced in part by All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com. Welcome to Let's Get Busy, a weekly podcast where I talk shop and get down to business with authors, illustrators, award winners, up-and-comers, and everyone in between. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 247 of the podcast with Peter Brown, author-illustrator of The Curious Garden, Mr. Tiger Goes Wild, and Children Make Terrible Pets. Peter's debut middle grade novel, The Wild Robot, is the book I needed to be in my life as a child and is the book I am enjoying with childlike wonder as an adult. It's about a robot. It's about surviving in the wilderness, and it's about how our experiences and the choices we make define who we are. I suppose at its core, it's about what it means to be. Here is episode number 247 of the podcast with Peter Brown. Let's get busy. Welcome to the podcast, Peter Brown. I have waited to talk to you.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I like that when we first set this up, and we've got so many mutual friends, and it's wonderful. We were talking before recording about how great everyone is connected in this kid-lit world and the library and teacher world and all that. It's wonderful. But to be connected with you so early on and to have the anticipation of really why we waited to talk, because you've got this middle grade novel coming out, The Wild Robot. It's been so exciting and such an honor to be building up to get to talk to you tonight.
Wow. Well, thanks. It's been a long time coming. You and I probably should have spoken earlier, but you know, it's been, hopefully it'll all seem worthwhile.
I think it'll be everything and more, because I had the privilege of getting a copy of the book, and I've been living with that for a while and reading it to my son and just living in it. And it's been great, Peter. Before I start gushing over your novel, though, I'd love to give you a chance just to tell the people listening tell the story of The Wild Robot.
Yeah, well, so The Wild Robot is the story of one robot named Roz who wakes up for the very first time and discovers that she's alone on this wild, remote island. And she doesn't know anything about how she got there or any sort of life before then. She's born on this island, and that's the only life she knows. But it's a rough life in the wilderness, and so it takes a toll. And her only real way of survival is by studying her environment and learning how animals survive. And by mimicking their behavior, she starts finding easier ways of existing in the wilderness. And by the end of the story, she's moving like an animal and talking like an animal. She can communicate with them. She's got animal friends and animal enemies, even an animal family. So she really goes through this huge transformation over the course of the story, which was kind of the whole point of why I wanted to write it in the first place.
I love this notion of what happens when we take, instead of bringing the wild into where we are, you know, and bringing nature into our captivity, rather, what happens when we take our advanced technology and drop it somewhere so primitive? Mm-hmm. And I feel like the way this story reads, there's a couple things. I was telling Actually, you'll get to hear this on recording. I was talking to Kate DiCamillo last week, and she was like, well, what are you reading now? And I said, actually, I'm reading The Wild Robot. And Kate would love to get a copy of your book, for one, so I'd send her love with that.
Nice.
But the thing I said to her there, which I found so fascinating and really wonderful, is that I felt like, you know, you've got these sort of mini chapters. Your chapters are all 2, maybe 3 pages long, for the most part. Mm-hmm. But each one, to me, reads like a picture book. Mm-hmm. Your the language that you use, the way that you frame little stories, just feels like you've collected almost these journal accounts of Roz on this island, mm-hmm. and they're all gathered to share with us. And the other thing that I really enjoyed was the discovery through the chapters that we really discover along with Roz. And I would say, as an adult reader, there were a lot of things that I sort of predicted along the way. I wonder if Peter's going to explore this idea, or I wonder if we're going to go here. If I was following steps logically, I wonder if this is going to go the direction I thought it would. And it did. And that fascinated me, that we were just observing and watching the change along with the character. It felt like, as a writer, it felt so fresh. It felt like we were getting something that was, I don't know, there was just so much life and vibrance in your story. It didn't feel like heavily edited, if you know what I mean. The life was not edited out of it.
Yeah. Well, that's good. You know, I there were so many challenges with writing this particular story. For starters, how do I get people to care about a robot? Hard to relate to a robot. It can be done. I mean, you know, there's some movies. Obviously, people love WALL-E, and I do too, and there's a robot that we care about. But when a movie, you know, there's a lot of tricks you can do. You can do a lot, you know, there's a lot of emotion you can show through body language that starts to help us care about this character. In a book, it was like I had to walk this fine line because I don't want to explain too much, you know. Like, I don't want to just sit there and tell you, explain every little thing, and that could get boring. So I had to kind of like find ways of revealing these things about the character very naturally, using her environment and using her own sort of discovery process, you know. And it wasn't, it was, you know, I'm glad that I didn't edit the life out of it, because let me tell you, I edited the crap out of it. it was insane, the kind of revision process that I went through to get the right balance of rhythm, of language, and I wanted to be super succinct. There is art in the book, but I didn't want to lean on it at all. Like, the storytelling came through the words, and the pictures were just kind of there to set the tone a little bit, you know. But it was a crazy amount of work. And you know, it's funny you mentioned that each chapter being almost like its own little story, and that's kind of how I thought of it. The only way I could wrap my brain around writing a novel for the first time was breaking it down into bite-sized chunks that I could digest, you know. And so what I did was I basically outlined the story until I got it to about 80 plot points. And each of those plot points, I decided I was going to turn that into a chapter. You know, and each plot point would, you know, maybe it was something like Roz gets in a fight with 2 bears. Maybe that's one point on my outline. And I was like, all right, well, this is the chapter where I talk about Roz getting in a fight with 2 bears. And so by doing that, I could kind of make it a little less overwhelming of a process. Then it wasn't a matter of writing a story. It was a matter of writing a chapter and then another chapter and then another chapter, you know, and eventually I had 80 chapters in the whole story.
That seems like such a great logical way to break down writing a story, to outline it that way. And I it's making me take notes for my children when I go back to teach them this idea that break down a task so it's not so overwhelming. You're right, writing a novel seems crazy overwhelming, but writing a chapter is something you can do. And then mm-hmm. write the next, and then the next is just one foot in front of the other, as it were.
Yeah. It was a lot. It was a lot in the beginning. And then once I started breaking it down, it felt much more manageable. It's still the emotional roller coaster, you know, was up and down all over the place. I don't want to make it sound like I didn't know at the time that this was necessarily going to work. It just seemed like a logical way to do it. And it kind of worked out.
I don't know how else to say this other than I wonder what things you discovered writing this novel, because there were moments in here that, well, here, do you mind if I read an excerpt to you?
Sure.
That something I found particularly moving, and this is about halfway through. Roz becomes a mother. She becomes a mother to a duckling named Brightbill, right? And a gosling named Brightville. And to have life, to have nurturing like that, these motherly qualities, and to put that against a robot, and how does a robot understand things like love and nurturing? But she understands because she sort of looks into her database and goes, no, this is how you do it. These are the factual things on how you do it. There was a moment, though, of emotion conveyed here that I found so beautiful. This is at the end of chapter 34, The Mother, that says, no gosling had ever had a more attentive mother. Roz was always there, ready to answer her son's questions, or to play with him, or to rock him to sleep, or to whisk him away from danger. With a computer brain packed full of parenting advice and the lessons she was learning on her own, the robot was actually becoming an excellent mother. That to me was profound.
Yeah, wow. I've never heard anyone read any words from this book before. It was that was pretty cool.
Oh, I'm honored to do so. I found this book, actually, quite frankly, I found this book to read aloud very, very well. And I credit that to just you being a great storyteller, but also the way you're saying that you approached it just chapter by chapter. And I know your sensibilities as a picture book author, and I know how well you edit yourself to make good stories to read aloud. And this felt like it was approached with those same sort of sensibilities.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I definitely can't, you know, escape the fact that I've spent most of my career making picture books. And I feel like the attention to wording and phrasing and rhythm was always going to be there. I never thought of myself, I don't think of myself as a poet at all. And in fact, one of my little rules that I made for myself is just not to try to be poetic with the language, but simply to tell the story as efficiently as I possibly can. I was so worried about boring readers that I was like, just get to the point and say things concisely. I think through the whole sort of process, my process that I went through, the language, you know, ended up here and there sounding slightly more poetic than I even meant it to, at least in a couple places. But yeah,
I like you saying, Peter, I don't mean to jump on your words, but you saying telling the story as efficiently as you can feels so Roz to me.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny you mention that, because I couldn't help finding those parallels between myself and Roz. I mean, you know, most authors will say their characters all reflect a little part of their own personality, and I was like, man, I have a lot in common with this robot. It was really kind of a strange realization. But I think that's kind of what I was trying to do, is I really thought of this story as like a realistic portrayal of what the future might look like. These robots are commercial products. People would own them like they own a car or own a computer today. And these things have been programmed to deal with household duties, you know, or for work sites or whatever. They're programmed to be sort of flexible. And so I was imagining those same programming capabilities being put to an unintended purpose, right? Which is survival in the wilderness and caring for animals. But maybe she was designed to care for animals. Maybe she was designed to work on a farm with animals. And that's part of why she has a nurturing, you know, tendency. But I really like the idea that this character could kind of like, I set the story up to seem like kind of a cliche. Roz looks like a pretty standard looking robot. In the artwork, and in the beginning she's acting very robotic, but I love setting up a cliche and then trying to smash it to pieces, you know. And so over the course of the story, I'm trying to show how this is not an ordinary character, and we haven't seen this robot before, and she's capable of things that she didn't even know she was capable of. And by traveling with her through her own journey, she doesn't know anything about herself. She just wakes up, just like a computer doesn't really know much about itself. One day she's powered on and she's in the wilderness. And we're following her as she learns about herself, you know. And obviously there's a lot that we can connect to in that sort of self-discovery process.
Oh, but good Lord, there's a moment in the book, and I won't spoil it, but there's a moment where you almost question mortality as an author, but then as what mortality means to a robot when in the very beginning of the story, this isn't giving anything away, there were a number of crates that fell over the boat. And most of them just smashed into the rocks on the edge of the island. And so, listeners, that's why Roz is so special, because she was the one that didn't smash. Mm-hmm. And the otters turn her on by finding this button on her head and press it, and she comes on. But at one point, she and Brightbeak go down and see the what is left of the remains of these other robots, and they have this, there's this conversation about the on switch that she has and what would happen if you press it. Mm-hmm. And are you willing to go there? And that there were a lot of moments like that, that that while I was going along with you, there were some questions I think I didn't want to be answered, and I could feel maybe that's the closeness I was feeling in this book, as you, the author, were telling, or you as the storyteller were telling us this story, there were some things that I wanted to know the answer to, and some things that I think were questions that were fearful. Mm-hmm. And do we have to face this, though? This is something that we have to talk about. And I really, it was that emotion, I think, that you're saying too, that maybe at points you didn't realize how emotive your writing would ultimately end up being. But I think it was because of the questions that you bring up. You're raising questions about humanity and what it means to be.
Yeah. Yeah. I was astounded at how philosophical everything started to become. I didn't know that was going to happen. I know one of the things I love about science fiction is how philosophical it tends to get by posing, you know, really kind of like moral questions about,
agreed,
you know, and I, you know, I love that about science fiction. I didn't know if that was going to happen in my story or not, but I felt like there were certain subjects I could not avoid. I had to talk about the fact that Roz is a robot, which means she has maybe an on-off switch. She has a power source. I didn't want to get into the technical side of things too much. That wasn't really the point. But there was like, I had to touch on that subject somehow. She has to get beaten up. We have to talk about what happens when she gets, when she's powered down. And for her to experience those things with her adopted son just kind of really amped up, I think, the emotional resonance, right? Because she doesn't know everything about herself, and the Gosling sure doesn't. So, you know, to put them together discussing sort of what life, what it means to be alive and mortality and things like that really just felt right to me. It just felt like a conversation that had to happen. It made sense. You know, this whole book was like a thought experiment. Like, I was trying to imagine what would really happen if we dropped an intelligent robot into the wilderness. And so every step along the way, by being, you know, each step is like kind of a baby step. We see her changing slowly and slowly, but by the end of the story, she's changed drastically. And it made sense that part of that transformation would include these kinds of conversations with living, breathing characters, you know?
Yeah. That was one of the first surprises for me in this story, and one that made all the sense after I read it. But the fact that Roz would find a way to communicate with these animals and ultimately would just understand these animals, and even have a point where she says, I think, to, I don't even remember what character, where she says, yeah, the language that I spoke, I don't speak anymore. Mm, like, mm-hmm. to see her sort of losing, yeah, a part of herself in order to become the person that she needs to be living in the environment that she is was interesting.
Yeah, that's in the scene where she and Bright Bill are talking about growing up, and Bright Bill asks her if she's grown bigger over the year, over her life, just animals do. And she says, I haven't grown bigger, but I've changed in many ways. And she talks about how she used to stand straighter, and she used to be shiny and clean, and she used to speak a completely different language. And I love that stuff personally. I just love imagining all the possibilities. I remember years ago, I was doing some sort of interview, and people, and one of the questions was, if I could have any superpower, what would it be? And I said, it would be the power to communicate with animals. And so with Roz, I felt like once I had this idea that she would be able to robotically study the environment like no human ever could, and understand the little nuances of body language of animals, that she would be able to communicate with these animals directly. Suddenly I was like, oh man, this is kind of like my dream come true. This is like, now I get to have all those conversations with animals that I wish I could have, but I can't. Roz can have those conversations. And so I was really like living kind of vicariously through this character. You know, it was great.
I love the names you give to all the animals. They seem almost like they were influenced by the way that Native American tribes named their own, that it was much more about who you are and your identity. Mm-hmm. And to have that alongside Roz in naming her Gosling and in knowing what each new friend she met was named. It was fun to have those names. I picture all the students that you're going to meet that will invent characters of their own, and they will already know your naming convention. They'll already have that down. Mm-hmm. It'll be easy for them to create characters for this world that you've created.
Yeah, naming the characters was, you know, can be the character's name can make or break a character, you know, a certain way. So I took it pretty seriously. And I just imagine these animals having their own little systems of doing things. You know, the geese tend to name themselves after physical characteristics. The bears are a little more independent, you know, and they're named a little more after just sort of things in the environment, you know.
Right.
And same with the deer. I imagined sort of more communal animals being a bit more having to distinguish themselves by physical characteristics. And so there's, you know, I don't get into this a whole lot in the story, but I had a little kind of an idea of the different naming systems that these different kinds of animals would have. And it all kind of makes sense when you throw it together, and you don't really need to explain it. But I had to understand all this stuff. Just like, this is a little bit of a tangent, but I had to understand Roz's original purpose and her design, her capabilities. You know, she was never intended to be on that island, but I had to know what was she intended for. And then I had to decide, how much of this do I have to reveal with the reader? So there's all sorts of little systems in place in this story, naming systems and Roz's own kind of computer programming and everything else that I had to know for my own purposes. And then just here and there would reveal little details when I thought it was important.
So what was your process of getting to know your characters that way then? Or maybe it's not too different from when you write picture books, but all here we're spending so much more time with these characters that you're right. There is a set of rules and guidelines, if you will, that mm-hmm. you as an author are definitely sticking to, because we as readers can see that. And yet, to be able to know your characters so well, like to be able to know Roz for the little that we know of her, it is that sense that any kid could come up and ask you, well, what about this? What about that? And you know the answer to her backstory already.
Yeah.
Of course you do. But yeah. That's awesome, though.
Yeah. Well, I was just terrified that this book was going to have loopholes in it. You know, I love science fiction, but a lot of bad science fiction is bad because there are pretty glaring loopholes that you feel like, you know, should have been addressed somehow. But, you know, you're supposed to suspend your disbelief a little bit when you read these stories. And yet I can never fully just suspend my disbelief. I always take note of when I see a loophole in some sort of fantasy or sci-fi story. And I was like, I just want to avoid that at all costs. So this story has to be consistent. I mean, I've got to think of everything. I racked my brain for the kinds of questions that I might get asked that would just, you know, like I lost sleep over this, you know, trying to think of every possible little loophole that might be in the story. And then even if I don't reveal its explanation in the story, I have to know for myself, and it has to be consistent with the rest of the story, because I don't want any gotcha questions. The last thing I want is some cute little kid raising his hand and asking me a question, me being like, oh crap, you're right, I totally didn't got that wrong. Oh my god, that can't happen. So, you know, I had to understand everything. And then even though I revealed very little of the background story, I had to know it for myself.
That's awesome. How long did you live with this story then? Did it live in your brain for a while, thinking about things like this, thinking about this logic before you started to outline?
So I was working on a picture book called The Curious Garden back in like 2008.
Goodness. All right. It's been alive since that long?
Yeah.
Wow. So
in The Curious Garden, you know, it's about an industrial kind of town, city with where nature starts growing kind of in surprising ways. And when I was working on those ideas, I kept thinking about interesting ways that nature and like technology might coexist, you know. And at some point, I doodled this little drawing of a robot in a tree. And it had nothing to do with The Curious Garden, but I love this idea of some robot in the wilderness. And so I kept, you know, for years at the time, I kind of knew it was going to be a story. I was like, I want to write a story where this scene happens, where they're, how do I write a story where we get a robot who finds harmony in the wilderness?
Hmm.
But I also thought, you know, this has to be a novel. There's no way this is a picture book. It's got to be a novel. And I'm not a good enough writer to do this. So I just need to put this on the back burner, you know, let it kind of simmer. And then maybe I revisit it down the road. And that's what happened. For about 5 years, I was just writing notes and reading science fiction and reading about animal behavior and reading about the natural world and artificial intelligence and all this kind of stuff and taking notes. And then after about 5 years of that, I was like, okay, I think I kind of have a grip on the story. I think my writing skills might be developed to the point where I can tell the story, you know, the right way. And that's when I started sinking my teeth into it, you know.
That's, speaking of the Curious Garden, by the way, I love that we have a mutual friend, Emily Arrow, that wrote a beautiful song for the Curious Garden.
Did. Yeah, so I feel like great.
That book continues to be on people's minds, which is really cool. But to think that Roz first walked into your subconscious way back then is amazing. That an idea sometimes can just, you know, it's a good idea when you just can't shake it, right?
Exactly. I mean, for years, I was mentioning this to my editor, Alvina Ling, who's edited everything I've ever written. You know, back then I mentioned it to her and she was like, yeah, she could see that this was a big idea and it needed some time. So she was like, just, you know, put it on the back burner. And for years, she's just saying, oh, that's great. You know, just keep working on it in your spare time. And then after like 5 years or what, she was like, all right, enough already. Let's just do this thing. Cause you keep talking about this story. You need to clearly you need to get this out of your system.
Nice.
And so, you know, kind of worked out.
Okay. So I have to say, just as a fan, that, the way, did you design your jacket?
Yeah, I designed the whole thing.
I assumed. Usually I know that's not the case cause I talked to novelists and someone else has done that, but the way your book looks and, I don't think this isn't going to offend you. This should be awesome to say this, but just to say it, it looks like a book from a Wes Anderson movie. And that is the greatest thing ever to me. It's designed, Peter, this book is designed so well that it looks like old and new at the same time. It looks like it's been around and it looks like it is just coming out. It's awesome.
Well, thank you. I mean, first of all, Wes Anderson is awesome. And the old and new thing is really awesome. Real quick, before I go any further, I shouldn't say that I designed the whole thing by myself. Dave Kaplan is the creative director at Little Brown, who I worked with, and he was amazing and patient. And I didn't know, I'd never done this before. And he just like held my hand and walked me through this whole process and helped me make really smart decisions. You know, together we made smart decisions about the book. But one of the goals was, you know, in the story, I wanted the book to feel kind of timeless. I didn't want it to be some like timely sci-fi novel that's cool now and then is irrelevant, you know, in 10 years from now.
Yes.
And part of the idea was using the language, the word selection, you know, there's a real lack of sort of contemporary phrases in the story. There's no mention of any kind of like modern technology aside from like a computer brain, which is pretty vague. And that was all intentional because I wanted the book just to feel like this kind of timeless thing. And the design, I wanted to reflect that as well. You know, the illustration style and the design of the book, I wanted it to feel old and new at the same time. So the fact that you just described it that way is like super amazing to me. So thank you.
It is awesome. I don't think I had seen the cover of it until either you shared something on Instagram or I got a copy in the mail. It was something like that. So it was real surprise pulling it out of the envelope. I had a moment. I will just say I had a moment. It was great.
Oh, that's so great. I love it. Yeah, thanks.
Oh, I should also say on behalf of my children that you are responsible for perhaps their favorite. And I mean, by children, I mean the 800 students that I teach and my son, that you are responsible for perhaps their favorite moment in all of children's literature, which is in Mr. Tiger Goes Wild, the reveal of a naked tiger and them freaking out is like the greatest thing ever as a librarian for me to reveal time after time while not reading aloud that book. So that book, by the way, is like, to me, for my money, that is the most beautifully designed and delivered book. I think that for me is the whole package. And I see your design aesthetic carried over in The Wild Robot and that same sense. So
yeah. Well, thank you. I mean, Mr. Tiger was a pretty special book for me. And that particular spread was one of my prouder moments, I have to say. You know, putting a new centerfold into a picture book was not something I thought would work, and yet it somehow happened.
Let me just tell you that we're on spring break now, but the week before we left, they were referencing your book in regards to that new movie Zootopia that came out, that I guess there's like I haven't seen it yet, but I guess there's like a nudist colony for the animals that they go to and the animals are naked. And they were like, it's just like in that book with the tiger.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's right. I haven't seen the movie yet.
But just the other day, you know, I was in Indiana last week visiting schools. And at one point I was in the library and this kid runs up to me and he says, so are you angry about Zootopia? And I said, why would I be angry about Zootopia? And he said, because they ripped off your idea.
Well, they ripped off your idea.
And I was like, well, now I'm angry, but I haven't actually seen the movie yet. I'm sure it's different enough where I won't be upset. But anyway, yeah, I'll have to check it out.
The same trick, though, the same pulling off that way is so good. Ah, yeah. The suspension of disbelief for the children to know that it's strong enough in your book to have that. To have that, as you say, that centerfold. Good Lord! That's, now you're taking it to another level. I haven't thought of it that way.
Well, the thing is, it is the centermost spread of the book. Like it is absolutely in the middle of the book. So I call it that sometimes. Of course, that's not a joke. Kids are gonna hopefully understand. So I don't mention it to them. But when I talk to adults about it, I can't help but phrasing it that way.
I have kids do my third graders do a mock Caldecott every year, and I know you've. There's a lot of schools that do it. I know your books have been on a lot of mock Caldecott lists, but for that book to study the two spreads that you have of here is Mr. Tiger sitting in the jungle and it's raining and here's the city and the way that you can just see the them being designed, you know, parallel, the things corresponded to each other. That was just so beautiful. I remember showing them too. I showed them the video. There was a video of you talking about how you worked in print and then you like scanned in and everything was in black and white and then added color. To see all of that come together was just a really neat thing. I try to make our mock Caldecotts as much as we can about the art, the process of the art as much as we can for them to just see that, like, look, you make stuff different ways. Yeah. And that was a really neat thing for them to see.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, I look at picture books as art objects basically.
Of course.
You know, and for a lot of communities and a lot of kids, it's the only real access to art, you know, is picture books. I mean, picture books come to them. They come to their library.
Yes.
The art comes to them. They don't have to go to a museum. I mean, with the internet, I suppose kids could look stuff up if they want to. But, you know, this is a lot for a lot of kids. This is their first exposure to art and design and story. And it's, you know, kind of feels like a responsibility, you know, to like do the best you can. Really push yourself to do your best work, because it could make a difference in a kid's life. And, you know, who knows? So I take all that stuff very seriously, even the explanations, you know, about how my process, whether it's in a video or a blog post or something else, I really want to like share kind of behind the scenes secrets of how these things are made so that kids have a better understanding and appreciation of how these things come together.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because for me to be able to try to explain to them, oh yeah, they did the work on the computer, and instead then to have a video to point them to show that. I know everyone designs a little bit differently and every artist uses their tools a little bit differently, but to be able to have things like that to point to are really cool. Hey, what do you have coming up after The Wild Robot that you can share?
Let's
see. You've got a bunch of stuff in various forms. But...
Yeah, I've got a lot going on. Let's see. First of all, I do want to write another Wild Robot story. You know, the ending is pretty open-ended.
Yes.
And I'm pretty excited about the next book, even though technically it's not even signed up yet with my publisher. I'm sure they're cringing. This is sort of an awkward situation for everybody, I suppose. But the story is going to happen. It's going to work out. It'll be fine. So I'm going to write another Roz book. And I actually think that it doesn't matter. Anyway, I'm really excited about the follow-up, because in a way, the opening book was just kind of like an intro to get to the next phase of the story. And there's a lot of like even more depth, I think, to the second story. But anyway, we'll let that go. It won't be out for a while because I haven't even outlined the thing yet, let alone anything else. So there's that coming down the pipeline eventually. I'm working on a follow-up to Creepy Carrots, a book I illustrated with written by Aaron Reynolds.
Yeah, congratulations. There was a Caldecott honor attached to that.
That's right. Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, so that beautiful work. And it won our, not that this supersedes the other, but it won our state book award in Maryland, our Black Eyed Susan book award that the students vote for.
Yeah, that's awesome. Those state awards, you know, are no laughing matter.
No doubt.
You know, they get, those books get to, into a lot of hands thanks to those awards. Mm. So I take the state, even just being like, you know, honorable mention or whatever in the state awards are, you know, it's really great. So I'm always excited when that happens.
Oh, it's great to know that there's another one coming out. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll do other picture books. And I even have other novels ideas. You know, I mean, in 10 years or so from now, maybe I'll take a stab at a YA novel. We'll see. But first, I want to try a few more middle grade novels. I've got some ideas that I'm really excited about, but they're all just daunting. And even though I've already written one, I'm still like, man, this is a major operation, you know? So it's, I have to like psych myself up for it.
Well, that's great, man. It's great that you're so busy and that you've got so many ideas and that you just get to be living that life of seeing one thing come to life and then challenging yourself in a new way.
It's incredible. I can't believe this is how I get to live my life. You know, I have so many friends who have what I call real jobs. And I'm like, this is my life. I wake up in the morning, I read for an hour, I drink coffee, and then I go to my studio and I start drawing and writing. And occasionally I travel and get to talk to people about my work. It's unreal, but
that's glad a good life.
It sure is.
Well, so I want to end with giving you the last word, but I'm going to bring it back to those kids that you'll get to see as you tour for this book and that I'll get to see when we return from spring break. So I'm going to leave you with this question. I'm going to see a library full of children tomorrow morning or as soon as I get back. So Peter, what message would you like me to bring them from you?
I think probably the message I would want to say is that to be a good writer, you have to be a good reader. I read all the time, and I think of it as part of my job. I enjoy it. I love reading so much. And when I was young, I was actually kind of a reluctant reader. But nowadays, I love reading, not just for the sheer enjoyment of it, but because I get ideas from it. You know, I get exposed to new thoughts and new ideas and new ways of writing and new ways of thinking from reading. And all that stuff informs my stories, and I would have a lot less to say if I weren't constantly filling my brain full of cool ideas that I get from other books. So I guess that would be what I have to tell them. Reading is a big part of writing.
Let's Get Busy is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland, and by All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton and The Best Book Ever This Week. Our theme music is by Blue Ducks. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referenced. Listeners, if this episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment on allthewonders.com or rate Let's Get Busy on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that is a very good thing indeed. Next up on Let's Get Busy, Dan Santat returns to talk about Are We There Yet?, his brand new picture book that I promise will literally make you look at picture books in a whole new way. And after that, Pseudonymous Bosch has secrets to keep and secrets to share, but not without first talking about Bad Luck, his second book in the Bad Books series. See you then, and thanks for listening. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.